Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Awesome.
I am well.
Good. Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell everybody a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We've been busting out themed weeks like you wouldn't believe. Clint Eastwood one week, Michael Bay the next. I hear there might even be a British gangster picture week in the works. I don't know yet. That's in the future. You know, who can say what the future will bring? But I don't even know if I'll have time to edit all of this wonderful content that you people are enjoying. We're spending good money on it, so I better. And we hope you will sign up for a membership. This will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. That's less than most Patreons. And, you know, we're way better than a Patreon. So I hope you enjoy the website. I hope you sign up. Now on to the show. First up, in controversies and non-controversies, it's Oscar season! And thankfully, everybody is being totally reasonable about the nominations and judging the movies based on their merit, rather than whether, you know, the categories hit some sort of arbitrary diversity quota. Oh, I'm sorry, I have that exactly backwards. That's all of the conversations have been about, you know, how many white men there are in all of the categories. As the token reactionary on the show, I have to say I love all of the nominees this year. You've got the hippie murdering buddy comedy. You've got the fast car dad movie. You've got the single shot war movie. And you have the movie in which Antifa creates Batman, the greatest of the superheroes. So this has been an amazing year. Great nominations all the way around. Greta Gerwig didn't even get a nomination for directing Little Ladies or whatever it was. Alyssa, what was not to love this year? What did you dislike about the nominees? You said you weren't going to curse. Now you're just being quiet. That's not going to work for a podcast.
I really wish I could describe Alyssa's face right now for the viewers, the listeners at home. But you'll just have to imagine
anger, flames on the side of her face.
Yes.
Okay. No. So because I am magnanimous, I'm going to launch an actual structural critique here. The Oscars are once again so white because Hollywood is super white. I don't actually have a ton to complain about with the Academy Award nominations relative to the things that were, you know, released this year. Mm-hmm. But like, look, Hollywood remains unbelievably monolithic, frequently very dull. And the Academy's big failure is in failing to recognize genres like horror, where women are actually getting to do a lot of really interesting work. I think you could argue that the big, you know, the big elisions in the nominations are probably Lupita Nyong'o for Us, for maybe Florence Pugh for Midsommar. And so, look, the Oscars are what they are because Hollywood is
what it is.
Although
Pugh did get nominated.
Yes. Pugh got nominated for Little Women.
Little Women. Yeah. And so I have achieved, like, as close as you can get to hippie liberal enlightenment about the entertainment industry and the Oscars, which is, like, the Oscars are they nominate the stuff that was from... They nominate from the stuff that was released in the previous year, and that's what they have to work with. And so if your activism about Hollywood is getting head up over a party at the end of the movie going season, like, you're not even remotely engaged with the actual issues in the industry. And so I'm just going to chill, I swear, and glare at Sonny over the podcast.
That's fair. That's fair. I will say that Lupita Nyong'o's failure to get a nomination for Best Actress for Us, the Jordan Peele horror movie that came out earlier this year, strikes me as more a function of when that movie came out.
Sure.
Coming out in February, March, or whenever it was, you know, it really, really hurt it, I think. Because I do think that if you had that movie drop in, like, October, and, you know, everybody talking about how great her performance is, and it was great, but you're right, there is also just a bias against horror movies.
Yeah, and we published a really good piece from Zachary D'Amico at the Washington Post today about that. I mean, increasingly what's interesting about horror is it's a genre that's been moving beyond the sort of final girl archetype, doing much more interesting things with roles for women. Ari Aster has a lot to do with this, but I mean, the Academy's general unwillingness to see the genre as serious, I think, has inadvertently produced a situation in which the Academy is ignoring a set of movies where there are great and unusual opportunities for women right now. And that is not necessarily reflective of a bias about women. It's reflective of a bias about genre. Both of those biases are stupid.
It is worth remembering, though, that Get Out also came out in February, and it was nominated, and it's a less female-centric film, and that does suggest, I mean, it's a somewhat more male film. I think Us should have been nominated for Best Picture. It's one of the better movies of the year. I can also see a scenario, though, in which Us, I think you're right, the release date does make some difference here. There's sort of notorious bias against movies that are released before October 1st, or not even bias against, people forget about them. They leave the consciousness.
Right.
And so that's why there's this
You saying the people who literally have like all of the movies delivered to them to watch in their private screening rooms, like somehow can't manage to watch them?
I am not excusing this. I am saying that it's simply true that that the closer to the end of the year you release your movie, the more you get buzz around, you are likely to get kind of discussion around your film at that point. Drive Oscar voters to put you in the nominating pool. It drives me mad because it means that, you know, if you are a movie critic or trying to write a top 10 list for the end of the year, that means the last 2 weeks of your year right before Christmas you're trying to see 14 movies, which is ridiculous, and also you're seeing all of this really high quality stuff, and in fact a lot of the movies released at the end of the year are really good, but it means that you're seeing all this really high quality stuff at the exact same time, and it becomes a little bit difficult to kind of make some of these distinctions in the way that, right, you can't give them the thought and the time that you really would like to if you had these movies spread out more evenly throughout the year.
It's not fair to us, is what you're saying. We are the real victims.
No, but I'm saying it's not fair to moviegoers, because moviegoers get this conversation started before Christmas with all of the awards, with the Critics Awards, and then with the Golden Globes. And moviegoers, in many cases, don't have a chance to see these movies at all until January, because often they release only in New York or LA. But even if they are wide releases, and let's imagine a world in which the Oscars, in which every movie that is good, and the Oscars and all the award season, the rule suddenly becomes you have to release on 2,500 screens before Christmas. And that becomes the new rule. If that's the case and everybody still drops their films in a couple week period, normal moviegoers cannot see a dozen films in that 2 week period. They're going to be spacing it out. They're going to be waiting in some cases for a streaming release.
Unlike us, they have families and obligations.
The reason I have not seen Little Women yet still is because I'm trying to see a bunch of other movies.
Because of the patriarchy.
It's because of the patriarchy.
We all know what the answer here is.
By which we mean Sonny Bunn.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Yes.
Our own personal manifestation of the
eventually picture. We'll all be forced to watch Little Ladies in our like little re-education pods. It's going to be
fantastic. When we're doing this podcast in 40 years, when the next iteration of Little Women comes out, I will make you do Little Women episode.
Never. You keep pitching a Little Women episode, and I keep finding something else to do. It's fantastic.
I will chase you into the hills and march you into re-education camp and force you to watch all billion adaptations of Little Women.
I'm going to burn one frame of Little Women at a time right in front of you. Just, you know, like what's her name?
This is war.
Okay. So one thing we did want to do for this part of the show is just highlight one thing we would love to see happen at the Oscars and one thing we would hate to see happen at the Oscars this year. Peter, I'll start with you this time since I trolled Alyssa so effectively on the last one.
Effectively?
What would you love to see happen?
I would love for Parasite to win Best Picture, not because I think it's actually the best movie of the year, but because it's a very good movie, and I would love to see a foreign language film win Best Picture, and for that barrier to be broken, and for audiences at an Oscar ceremony that is probably going to be more widely viewed than maybe the last couple of years, just because Joker's nominated, because of the pool of films, right? When you have bigger films in the Best Picture category, it tends to drive viewership.
Black Panther was nominated for Best Picture last year.
That's true.
I don't think this year's like crop is that much bigger than last year's.
That's true, but it looks, I mean, I would guess that this is going to be an Oscar ceremony that is going to draw a little bit more attention. I would like to see I would just like to see a foreign language film that is a great film. Not like I said, not the best movie of the year, but a very good one. I would like to see it win.
I think we can wait for the Adam McKay adaptation of Parasite to win Best Picture.
Oh God!
All right,
it's gonna be an HBO. It might not even be terrible, but it's gonna be an HBO limited series, not something that's gonna be up for an Academy Award.
Alyssa, what would you love to see happen?
I would love to see either Brad Pitt or Joe Pesci win Best Supporting Actor. These are two of my favorite performances of the year. And they're related in some ways in that they're fairly quiet roles about men who spend a lot of their time observing other people, but have, in one case, a very intimate connection to violence, and in another, a somewhat removed connection to violence. I also just want Joe Pesci to actually be recognized as the great actor that he is. And both he and Pitt have often been, I think, sort of underestimated and in Pesci's case, really sort of underused in certain ways. So I would love to see one of them win that particular category.
I would love to see Adam Sandler win a write-in campaign for Uncut Gems. It's ridiculous that he wasn't nominated
for Best Actor.
Agreed.
I completely agree.
But failing that, I would love to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood win Best Picture and Quentin Tarantino to win Best Director. Quentin Tarantino keeps getting nominated for Best Director and not winning, and it's going to be annoying to me when he does not win again this year. I will be vexed, but... What such is life, I suppose. All right, what is one thing you would hate to see happen at the Oscars, Peter?
Oh, I'd hate to see Joker win Best Picture, Best Director, or Best Adapted Screenplay. I did not like that movie, and I don't want it or its fans to come away.
Objectively speaking, from the Oscar nominations it received the most Oscar nominations of the year. That means it's the best of the movies.
No,
it's
just objectively the best of the movies.
Yeah.
It's better than all of the other nominated. It's better than
lies.
So we're gonna
it's
have
better than all the other movies.
We're gonna have more conversations about the Oscars over the next couple of weeks. But I'll just say that this is my big beef with the Oscars: is that people have to. So when you both with the protesters and with the people who are like, "Oh, I love the Oscars and Oscar season," people shouldn't buy into this idea that the Oscars are a mark of quality. The Oscars are an advertisement for Hollywood and for Hollywood's glitzy luxury, whatever. The thing
that's
they want to sell you that
isn't...
The glitzy
luxury of Joker, of the gritty the crime,
glitzy luxury,
murder drama.
Of stardom, of fancy people
the
making
glitzy stardom,
millions of
the
dollars.
The glitzy stardom of Joaquin Phoenix grumpily answering everyone's questions about how
there,
much he hates acting.
He's going to be there in his custom tux that he's wearing
His
one tux that he's wearing throughout all of awards. Season.
All right, I'm sorry, Alyssa, what is one thing you would hate to see happen?
I would really hate to see Todd Phillips win Best Director for Joker. It is a stupid person's idea of a smart or deep or artistically interesting movie.
Movie of our times.
And, wrong.
It's the movie of our age. It is
wrong,
the movie that
wrong,
most understands
wrong.
What is happening in America and the world, and there's a reason. There is a reason this movie has been adapted as a symbol of resistance by people in nations across the world is because it hits our moment in a very real way. I would hate to see Phoenix not win for Joker since Sandman is not nominated. It would be a Travesham mockery because he did, as Alyssa said before the show started, he did the most acting, and that is the best form of acting, the most acting that you do.
He had to make up for all the weight that he lost, and so in order, because there was less of him, he had to act more.
I mean, if you're going to lose all that weight, you might as well show it off with your, shirtless dancing. In the
and
room
gross
or whatever.
Underpants. Yeah.
All right. On to one of this year's award season favorites, Marriage Story. As always, beware spoilers from here on out. Marriage Story is about a marriage, kind of the way that Joker is a story about comedy. Marriage Story is actually Marriage Story is actually a piece of emotional terrorism designed to strike fear in the heart of most reasonably happy people who know that lingering just under the surface are all manner of resentments that just need a little push to send people over the edge. I have to be honest, I didn't love this movie. I loved things about it. I think Adam Driver is truly wonderful in this, as he is truly wonderful in most all things. Again, before the show, we were kind of talking about just his physicality. I like how he sits on the couch in the meme scene that everyone has latched on. But just the way he kind of folds himself over and the way he crosses his legs, I was like, that's the most realistic way anyone has ever sat on a couch on film before. So I like him. I like him. He's good. And as a Douthatian, I am always up for highlighting the awful ugliness of the divorce industry and like how that kind of works and like how it can be used terribly and awfully to hurt people. But the movie as a whole felt somewhat sloppy and meandering. The tightness that was present in The Squid and the Whale, which we talked about last week, is totally absent here. It just meanders. It goes all over the place. And I can't help but think that shagginess is at least in part thanks to Netflix's effort to win the war on sleep by making sure everything is like 25% longer than it needs to be. And this has happened in another Baumbach film, the Meyerowitz Stories, which was like, I think, about the same amount of running time as this one, maybe a little shorter, but it feels like he has gotten a little bit lengthier since he has kind of made this move. Anyway, Peter, on the other hand, he loved this movie, and I know Alyssa, you liked it too. So, Peter, we'll start with you. Why don't you tell me why I'm wrong about this specifically? Remember, we only have like 15 minutes for this segment.
Yeah, so
I can't go into all of the reasons why I'm wrong about all things.
Let's start with Watchmen and okay. Zack Snyder. No, let's the. What I loved about this movie was how open and less... So I had to see it in kind of in the context of The Squid and the Whale, which we talked about in the last episode. The Squid and the Whale is a very sharp-elbowed movie. It's extremely judgmental about its characters. It says that they are really kind of messed up people, especially the parents, but the kids as well. And Marriage Story, somewhat understandably, given that it's the story of his own marriage, is a movie that isn't... that doesn't judge its characters nearly as harshly. It is gentle with them. It understands that they're flawed. It allows both of them to be difficult people in certain ways, to make mistakes. It balances those the mistakes in the marriage really quite nicely, and in a way that I thought was really effective at not seeming quite like it was calculated to be balanced, right? You can imagine a version of this movie in which it just sort of seems like they're kind of stacking errors on each side, and along with, you know, like two things you really like about this person and two things you really hate, and it's just designed to say, okay, they're equal, right? But the movie doesn't do that, and yet at the same time, it really feels like this is a marriage of equals in which they are both... They've both done some things that are wrong, and both also have brought some things that are really nice to the marriage. I also want to point out how great the direction and the production design on this movie is in a way that's really interestingly unshowy. And so this is a movie that isn't super stylish. We're going to talk about Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels in a little bit. It's a very stylish movie that calls attention to the direction. Marriage Story doesn't really call attention to its direction. But think of the scene in which they go and negotiate. They kind of negotiate the settlement. And the way it is staged in this triangular room. It is a room in which the two couples and the two sides are literally being brought into a point, right? It is a physical representation of their marriage and of the scene that is happening. And then think of a scene like the one with Alan Alda in his office, who's this sort of very gentle, nice lawyer, and he's there to show, you know, in some ways that the system could be a little nicer to people, that it doesn't have to draw you into anger and meanness and hostility towards the person that you're trying to separate from. And just the perfect way that his office is staged, and even the break room where you see this kind of sad little space, and you see how underwhelming it is, and just the ordinariness of it, that in a way that really just sells the scene in a great way. And so there's a lot of great performances, there's a lot of great production design, and there's a lot of very unshowy, subtle, excellent direction that I think... a lot of people who are like, oh, I like directors and I like visuals and I like style, might miss on first viewing. And so it's a great and wonderful relationship movie.
It is an actorly movie. A movie that is very much about like letting the actors kind of do their thing.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about, I've seen Marriage Story twice now, and I think I love it. But one thing I was thinking about watching it the second time around is, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's an LA movie. And the way the movie is lit is less intense than the sort of very, very golden LA sunlight that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood uses. But it's sort of buttery and soft. And in a way, the lighting kind of weights the movie a little bit towards Nicole's character and towards Charlie's ultimate decision to like come out to LA. New York is always shot sort of, it's all interiors. You don't get much of a sense of the city.
Cramped.
Yeah, but you get this. I mean,
there's so much space.
Yeah, you have that constant joke. But the again, in the production design, it kind of lulls you into the place that the couple ends up getting, which is in LA, finding a new way to be together. It's just very warm. It's also, we haven't talked about how funny a movie this is. And one of the reasons that I was so delighted to see Laura Dern get nominated for Best Supporting Actress is that she is getting it to do it for a role that is incredibly funny, not self-effacing, and also really hyper-feminine. And not just hyper-feminine, but she's a character who kind of weaponizes her hyper-femininity. You have this scene in divorce court where she and Ray Liotta's character are just going at each other, totally vicious argument. And she starts taking off her blazer, and she's wearing this very, it's sort of purple, black, strappy. It has kind of lingerie elements to it. And she's clearly doing it to disorient him, and it's kind of working. And so to have that character be as funny and as complicated as she is, it's, I mean, it's the kind of nomination that in a year where more women had gotten recognized for more things might be held up as a point of saying, look, the Academy can kind of get the complex work that women can do.
Do you think the movie blames Laura Dern's lawyer for the ugliness of the divorce?
I don't know. I mean, there's definitely that moment towards the end where she explains that she altered the custody agreement, clearly to just satisfy her sense that she has to come out ahead. At the same time, you know, as you see in that early mediation scene, there was stuff in that marriage that was sort of too ugly to be dealt with in that way. And to a certain extent, she kind of forces it all to the surface and lances the boil. Like, I don't know if Charlie ultimately takes the, you know, the fellowship at UCLA and comes out and does some directing there without that process. You know, I don't know that the movie holds her responsible for the ultimate ugliness that develops. But I do think it sees her as sort of instrumental. Like, the movie doesn't morally approve of her.
I think it's interesting that her natural counterweight is not Alan Alda, cannot be Alan Alda. It is Ray Liotta's shark of a lawyer.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that Adam Driver's character feels the need to bring in Ray Liotta's character is it strikes me as a cinematic indictment of the lawyer. Now, this is not to say that Laura Dern's not doing good work, that it's not an interesting role. Yeah. But it is kind of interesting how Baumbach weights the kind of opposing counsels against each other.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an indictment of the counsel, of the lawyer herself. I don't know that I would say that the movie entirely approves of her, but what the movie is doing is saying that the system creates incentives, first for Laura Dern's character to act the way that she does and to bring in clients based the way that she does, and then to try and fight for them in a particular way because she gets paid, because she gets, that's her what her reputation is based on, because that is part of how she develops a relationship with a client who is going through this, is to, in some ways, to pull that person away from the spouse that they are divorcing. And so this is a movie about the divorce system and the way in which
the industry of divorce,
two people who want it, like, it's, I mean, the easiest way to sort of describe this movie is about two people who want to get divorced nicely and find that it's almost impossible to do. And it is impossible to do not because of a bad person, Laura Dern. It's impossible to do because of a network of laws and cultural expectations, and because of their own history, and because, in fact,
they just want different things, though.
Right. And in fact, divorce is ugly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it is. It's trying to kind of get at this, like, you think you're going to, like, you. Yes, of course you loved this person.
No.
In some ways, you still do. On the other hand, look at what you are doing to the relationship and to that person.
But to a certain extent, what happens to them in their divorce process is a compacted version of the harm they've already done each other, right? I mean, it's
right. It's Marriage Story, not Divorce Story, and yet it's the story of a divorce because the divorce is the marriage in miniature.
Right.
As I said, it's not really about a marriage. It's about Well, whatever. What did we think about the performances in this movie? This is, again, a very, as I said, a very actorly movie.
Yeah.
I love Adam Driver, as I said.
I think we all love Adam Driver.
I think he's just great. I watched the Terry Gilliam Don Quixote movie a couple of weeks ago, and he's just fantastic in that, even though the movie is kind of weird and doesn't quite work.
I don't think I've ever seen him be less than excellent
something. He's fantastic.
And whoever is helping him pick projects, like, his agents, whoever, like, he just has real good
taste. He's now worked, who has he worked with? He's worked with Spike Lee, he's worked with Terry Gilliam, I mean, like, the Coen brothers,
And you can hate Lena Dunham, but she is an auteur, and she was the one who found him and made him a national going concern.
Yeah. But what about, let's talk about Scarlett Johansson. I mean, we haven't really even talked about Scarlett Johansson at all. She is, like, half of this movie. Did you guys see Jojo Rabbit? I
have not.
No, neither of you have. It's interesting that she is nominated for both of these movies because they are very different kind of portraits of motherhood and what it means. But I don't know. I've always been a big ScarJo fan. I thought she's a very nice screen presence. And I have to be honest, she didn't entirely work for me in this movie, and I'm not 100% sure why. I have no idea where to go with this other than to say, like, I'm not entirely sure this work, her performance here worked for me, but did it for you guys?
It worked really well, and I thought she made a great match with Adam Driver. And I also think that it's a great way of showing off how versatile an actress she is, because she's doing this. And after being a major part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right, the same year that that her character plays a pivotal role in Avengers Endgame, and in which, 6 months before she gets her first big, solo film, she did Ghost in the Shell. She's done all of these, bigger action movies. And now she's also showing up in a little tiny actorly relationship drama next to one of maybe the best actor of, that generation of people who are, in their mid to late 30s.
Well, and the movie is partially about how she's versatile, right? I mean, the scene where she is filming that, like, clearly god-awful, totally green-screened pilot, and sort of having the argument with the director about how to hold the baby.
Baby, which is a green box.
Yes. And doing the sort of...
That scene.
And doing the walk and talk afterwards about how, like, maybe she could direct. I mean, that's really funny. But it also shows you the thing that Charlie says about in her letters. Like, she's my favorite actress. She thinks for all this stuff. You see her doing this, like, goofy, experimental theater nonsense and, like, totally selling it, being very committed. Like, she, you see why she is Charlie's favorite actor. I think the movie,
and I know you have another thought, but I want to, like, stop on that moment. Yeah. It's so good. That's what love is, guys. Like, when you are married to your favorite actress, when you're married to movies always get love wrong. Movies think love is, I think this person is beautiful and they seem nice, or they seem funny. No, love is you like a specific thing about your partner.
Yeah.
It is that you imagine them in a particular circumstance. They are doing something. They have a particular quality. They have a set of habits, often several, not just one. But in a movie, you kind of have to condense it into one thing. This is a movie that actually gets what importantly, what deep, intimate marital relationships are built on, which is that you like something specific about your partner more than anyone else in the world.
Yeah. And if her performance didn't quite work for you, Sunny, I wonder if it's because you see sort of less of her arc in it to a certain extent. Charlie goes from being totally resistant to the idea of Los Angeles and not really sort of seeing what's been happening in his marriage to making an accommodation with it after it's too late, and in a way that's kind of heroic. I mean, during that trick-or-treating scene, like, he's cut out of the costume, he's in this, like, silly ghost outfit, he's sort of in
Invisible Man.
Yeah, he's literally sort of, he's out of step, he's not a part of things in any way, but he's still showing up, and he's showing up for his marriage after the point when it's over, and it's genuinely sort of heroic. And you do not see that happen with her character yeah. in quite the same way, right? I mean, you have those early scenes, like the movie never returns to her working on the show. You never see her directing, right? You see that she has the new boyfriend, mm-hmm. the flirty grip, but we don't see what that relationship is really like. And part of it is that there's just a much stronger ensemble on her side of the movie. Like, you have Mara Weaver, who is fantastic, and you should both watch Unbelievable if you haven't already. She's so good in it. You have her mom. You know, you have this sort of other cast of characters who are very good and add a lot of sort of texture and warmth and weirdness to the movie, but she just gets less of an arc. Yeah. And so I think it's a very good performance, but I think the material is somewhat less strong. And to a certain extent, like, this is a story about Noah Baumbach's marriage. It's not Jennifer Jason Leigh's movie about her marriage to yeah. Noah Baumbach.
No, it is. I do wonder if that is maybe the problem here, is that the character is just not as interesting to me. So,
well, I think Baumbach has, it's not just a movie about his divorce from Jennifer Jason Leigh. He has clearly mm-hmm. blended some of his current relationship with Greta Gerwig into this film. Hence the I'm going to be a somewhat odd actress who is good and gets noticed and then becomes a director,
yeah.
Which is what has happened with Greta Gerwig, yeah. Gerwig, who he has been with for the last 8 years or so.
All right, so what do we think here? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Marriage Story? Alyssa?
Thumbs up, but do not watch it with your spouse.
Peter?
I loved it. I think it's my second favorite movie of the year.
So that's a thumbs up?
Yes.
You have to say the thing.
Thumbs up.
There we go.
Way up. All the way up.
Thumbs down. Now we turn to assigned viewing. Up this week is Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Why are we watching Guy Ritchie's debut feature, Peter? This is his debut feature, right? I didn't actually look it up.
I think it is.
Yeah.
So this week we're watching Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels as preparation to talk about director Guy Ritchie's next crime film, The Gentleman. Lock, Stock is Ritchie's 1998 debut film, released the year he turned 30 years old, and it's stylish, vulgar, jaunty, kind of part Tarantino, part Elmore Leonard, maybe a little bit of Nick Hornby with a lot of late 1990s sass. It's about a quartet of young men who go all in on a high-stakes card game with a notorious gangster, and then when things go wrong, find themselves in debt to the tune of about 400,000 quid. They end up in an ultra-violent comedy of coincidence, as they and several other factions of stylish London gangsters end up pursuing a giant stash of drug money. So this movie not only launched Ritchie's career, it also introduced us to actors Jason Statham and Vinnie Jones, and it helped put producer Matthew Vaughn, who was actually even younger than Guy Ritchie. He was only in his late 20s when he was produced this film. It put him on the map. Vaughn, of course, has gone on to direct movies like Layer Cake, X-Men First Class, and, of course, the Kingsman films. I love the wit and stylishness of Lock, Stock. You know, there's all these freeze frames, these musical montages. It's got this great kind of weird brown and gold color palette. And, of course, the menswear is just incredible. It has really memorable characters and ornate, tough guy dialogue. It's a good example of how stylized and entertaining you can be with no-name actors, except for Sting, on a fairly limited production budget. This movie was made for about $1.3 million, which I guess would be maybe $2 million or so in today's, but it's really a pretty small budget. If I have a complaint, it's that Ritchie has repeated himself too much since making Lock, Stock, with nearly all of his films, even things like his King Arthur movie, relying on the same set of visual tricks and even the same kind of plotting in which a bunch of factions end up chasing after some MacGuffin and then end up canceling each other out in a violent comic fashion at the end. And so in Lock, Stock, it works really well, and he's not obviously repeating stuff that he's done before, but once you've seen Lock, Stock, it ends up being, a kind of a key to the rest of his movies in which he's never really moved beyond a lot of the ideas that are in this film. Still, I love it, and I really enjoyed rewatching it. Alyssa, Sunny, what about you?
I had not watched Lock, Stock before this, and it struck me watching it that it's such an essentially English movie, and I don't mean that just because of the accent. It's because it's so incredibly mannered. It's in a weird way like watching Downton Abbey, but for guys instead of chicks.
It's awesome then, instead of boring.
Sunny is very excited by this possibility.
The line about how the entire British Empire was built on cups of tea is like, basically the Dowager Countess of Grantham could have said that. I did not love this movie. I thought it was fine. It is, like, the fact that it gifted Jason Statham unto the world is clearly a major contribution. But I felt like, and this is, I've seen a lot of other Guy Ritchie movies. I don't know how I had somehow not seen this, but the relationship and the chemistry between the four guys is so warm and natural and interesting, and comes across so well in that opening scene with Jason Statham going through this patter to sell obviously stolen and counterfeit goods. And then it just gets so cluttered up by the rest of the movie. And everything else in it other than that sort of central chemistry is ultimately not that interesting to me. And I get that it's clever. I get that it's mannered and, you know, it's clearly smartly plotted, but it just sort of loses that sense of emotional engagement for me. And
yeah, no, I have to say, this has never been one of my favorite Guy Ritchie movies. Honestly, it is. I love Snatch. I love Snatch. It is one of my favorite movies, favorite comedies of all time, like favorite action comedies of all time, because it is funnier than this movie in very like specific, like, I don't know, joke telling sorts of ways. Like this movie is like kind of it's almost a grind. Like it almost feels like a little bit oppressive as things like keep kind of going wrong. I don't know how exactly to describe it. But the things that are good about it are the things that are good about all of the Guy Ritchie movies. Like you say, the relationship between the characters and kind of how they interact with each other. I am a sucker for his like stylistic tics, Peter. I can watch the same things happen in his movies all week. I would be okay with that.
I did enjoy the subtitled Cockney rhyming slang, and actually he should have leaned into that
yeah.
more.
Yeah, and there's yeah. that's a great little bit, and again, I do love Jason Statham in this.
It's really interesting seeing a movie star emerge like that, right?
Just fully formed. Yeah. Like this is like Jason Statham. I mean, this is his first real movie.
Yeah. He'd been in a couple of shorts before.
And he was a diver.
Yeah. He's a fascinatingly like, again, like Adam Driver, he has his own physicality that's yeah. like kind of weird and unique to him. And he's like, a sophisticated thuggishness as yep. opposed yeah. to like Vinnie Jones, who is like has a thuggishness to him, or like Stephen Graham, who has like kind of a silly thuggishness to yep. him. There's a reason he works so perfectly in the Driver movies
or in Spy, where he gets to wear Spy, yeah. fantastic suits yeah. and be really funny but also clearly very dangerous.
Yeah. I've always been kind of cold on this, and watching it again, I wasn't warmed up.
I mean,
by it.
The scene where they're all drinking together after the score is so sort of warm and naturalistic, and I kind of love that. I wanted kind of that movie.
I think part of it for me,
and that's
is,
just not the movie that yeah, Guy Ritchie right. makes. It's like not, I get that. Yeah, it, you know.
I think part of it for me is the color palette yeah. that you mentioned, Peter. Like the kind of brownish, like it just looks like I'm watching the whole thing through a Newcastle bottle. You know,
it doesn't look intentional.
It does look intentional.
Well,
and
well,
I just
they,
like,
but it looks like they slapped like the an Instagram filter on.
Yeah,
it.
And you know, Snatch has its own kind of filter on it. It's got more of a blue-gray tint to it, which maybe I just like more. I don't know. But the
quite a few of his films have a very distinctive color palette. Yeah. It's less true in his big-budget movies, in the Sherlock Holmes, King Arthur, yeah, yeah. Aladdin, whatever universe.
Chav King Arthur.
Yeah. I hate that movie, God.
It's so terrible.
It's so bad.
It's not
elephants,
a good movie.
Elephants. I mean, God, just what was that?
I mean, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. has a very distinctive yep. color palette. Guy Ritchie just clearly likes to impose color from the outside, right? He rarely allows color to be natural.
Yes. No, I think that's probably a good way to put it. I still think his most underappreciated movie is Rock and Rolla, which has early Tom Hardy in it. It has early Tom Hardy and early Idris Elba, or at least early by American
Early-ish.
Standards.
Yeah.
Which is in my dream universe, in my like Dr. Manhattan created universe, you know, that I've like built
on
out
Mars.
Of it. Guy Ritchie is making nothing but these movies and not the like Sherlock Holmeses and Man from U.N.C.L.E.'s and Aladdin's.
It does look like that's what he's going back to with The Gentlemen. I gotta say, I have fond memories of Rock'n'Rolla and also can't remember what... Whether it's Revolver or not.
No,
and
Revolver
and Rock'n'Rolla in my head are exactly the same movie.
Revolver is the terrible, like, split personality, multiple identity disorder one that, like, there's, like, a big twist at the end, and I remember watching this movie, and at the end of it, during the credit sequence, there's somebody, like, talking about the disease that the character has and, like, explaining what happened in, like, the last 10 minutes to the audience. Literally just, like, a talking head interview being like, this is what you just watched. And I was like, well, this movie didn't work. This movie clearly didn't work if you have this in the credits sequence.
I remember watching this movie when I was in college. And so the Lock, Stock came out in 1998. My freshman year was 1999. I obviously didn't go to class at all. I spent all of my time watching movies in my dorm room. And I watched this, and I remember being really blown away by it. And so I was very excited then to go see Snatch when it came out in 2000. And because I was already pretty familiar with kind of the legend of Guy Ritchie and what he was capable of. And I loved Snatch as well. And in some way, I can see why you might like it better. It is it really works in the same territory, in the same mode, but it feels like the ideas are a little more developed. And he had both the time and the budget. He was working with people who had more experience rather than this kind of shoestring, you know, let's just put it together.
The cast in Snatch is also just, I mean, it's Brad Pitt and Benicio Del Toro.
Yeah.
On top of Jason Statham and, you know, Stephen Graham.
But
and,
Alyssa, I wanted to ask you about this because when I went to see Snatch, I went to see it with a group of dudes, but also there were some women who came with us in college and who were obviously not, like, already big Guy Ritchie fans because there weren't that many in the United States to begin with, and they just weren't super into that. And they came away from it thinking,
and
well...
And they weren't women, mostly.
Right. So what all of them said, basically, there was like a... I don't want to be like all women, but the group that I was with all pretty much said the same thing. Well, that was interesting. Brad Pitt's hot. I can see why you might like it, but oh my God, that's such an incredibly male movie. It's just like the most male thing I have ever seen. And I was thinking about this with Lock, Stock. There is, if I am not mistaken, only one female character in the movie, and it is...
And she's a joke.
Well, she's sort of a joke, but it's the woman who announces the rules for the card game.
Well, no, and then there is the...
there's the stripper.
There's the woman who is, like, dragged home, basically, like, roofied unconscious.
Oh, that's right. That's right, yes. So literally the woman who we are supposed to ignore.
Yes.
And whose ignorability is a key plot point because one of the factions, the crews here, doesn't see her.
Yeah.
As people don't see her. And then she blows them all away in a pivotal moment with, like, something like a Tommy gun. In any case, I was just curious. How do you feel about this movie's, like, just... absolutely intense masculinity and like its complete disregard for the female experience.
So I think this is something that distinguishes me from some other sort of self-identified feminist critics. And I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't tend to get super turned off by hyper-masculine movies as individual movies. And part of that, the recently deceased Elizabeth Wurzel wrote in her book, Bitch, that, you know, men are, if you're a woman, and especially if you're a woman who has relationships with men are a really fascinating, important subject. You have to figure them out because they sometimes hold the power of life or death over you. And so I don't mind hyper-masculine movies like this. And to a certain extent, it's kind of fascinating to get to peek into the boys' club and see what men are like when women are not around. I did not love the joke with the girl who was like stoned or drugged out of her mind because I was really anxious for her for a lot of the movie. And it's something about the movie that I assume Ritchie just didn't think about how, like, I assume it just would never occur to him that a woman would watch this movie and be constantly scared that she was going to be day raped. Or just, let's be honest, that she was going to be raped because she's basically unconscious for 90% of her time on the screen. And so I don't love that. You know, the sexploitation, the sex position stripper stuff, like, I'm sort of inured to at this point. Like, it's nonsense. Everybody does it. You know, sucks, and I wish people didn't do it, but it's a thing.
This was also 22 years ago when there were fewer complaints about that mode of exposition.
Or those complaints absolutely existed. They just weren't empowered, you know, in the discourse. Like, let's be clear, feminist film critics have been writing about this stuff forever.
The complaints were quieter and
they
harder
were given,
to
they
not
were given
see
less credence, and they were not elevated in the same way and given the same platforms. So the maleness in the movie doesn't bother me. It interests me. And look, this is one of the reasons that I am so tired by men who are not interested in stories that are predominantly about women, because theoretically, like, isn't that interesting if you don't get to see it? You know, isn't it fascinating to get to peek into a world that you don't have access to on a daily basis? Yeah, Sonny, you do your thing over there.
I'm not saying anything.
So the moral of Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels is see Little Women.
Little Ladies.
100%. But no, it doesn't bother me. I think, though, that because this movie is so concerned with its sort of plotting intricacies, it becomes less interesting on that score.
Yeah.
All right. Next week's assigned viewing is Snowpiercer, which we are watching to prep for Parasite, another one of our catch-ups. We gotta catch up on all these Oscar movies that we missed because, you know, some of them came out before we started the show. That's it for this week on Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Before we go, I'd like to read a review from our Apple Podcast page. My favorite review this week comes from FishFisher44, who says, "It's fine." That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me. Certainly, you know, it's fine.
And yet it's a five-star review.
Five-star review. That's the highest compliment you can pay to anyone. It's fine. It's fine. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple, like our friend FishFisher44 did. If you don't like us, just complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.